Inkstuds, yeah, TI 101.9 FM. That was Eamon Tobin, Verbal, the Tipio Biggio mix.
I think it's Topo Gigio.
Topo Gigio, oh yeah.
His old Ed Sullivan performer.
It is. I am joined by my co-host, as always, Colin Upton.
Hello.
Hello. And our special guest this week, Scott McLeod, author, cartoonist, educator, academic.
I guess.
Of the trilogy of comics, Understanding Comics, Reinventing Comics, and lastly but not least, the most recent Making Comics, which came out from, I think it was at Harper's?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I can't remember. From Harper's. One of many publishers, I guess, you've been working with over the years, putting out the volumes.
Harper's kind of swallowed me whole now. I think it's just Mr. Harper now.
Mr. Harper. Yeah. There we go. So you're in town today for, you're doing a signing and I guess a bit of a Q&A? Or is it just a signing?
Oh, darn it, I can't remember now, because I was wondering the same thing.
I think it's a
Q&A. I think it might be Q&A also.
No, who's doing the Qs? I guess the audience?
Yeah. Anyone who feels like it.
Mind their P's and Q's. So, tonight, Sophia Books, what's the address? I can't remember the address.
Yeah,
it's on Hastings.
Street, somewhere.
Across from the Harbor Center.
It's actually, if you go to scottmcleod.com and click on the little picture of us driving the car, you'll go straight to the tour page, and it has that
info.
Because I don't remember it either, so if you want to know, it's there, right there.
It's right next to the Waves, you know, like Richards or something?
Yeah, Richards and Hastings. Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
There you go.
So, this is your latest stop in, I guess... You started this tour in August last year? Was it September?
Yeah, right at the end of August, we started driving from Los Angeles to New York, but the official launch was in New York, so we didn't get to count any of the states along the way, right? So it started in New York. September 5th was the official launch. So we only got 3 months to go, and we've done 38 American states, 4 Canadian cities, and cities in England and Spain.
Wow.
This is just the first part, is it? planned?
No, it's just 12 states to go, and then we're done.
Oh, okay. So no tour of Japan.
Oh, my daughter would love that. My 14-year-old daughter, Sky, is obsessed with Japan. She really wishes that I would get myself invited to Japan. I actually did. Years ago, I got invited to Japan, and I said, oh, you know what? I want to wait until my book is out in Japanese. And then they asked me the next year, and I said, no, I still want to wait until my book is out in Japanese. Then they asked me the next year. I said the same thing. The next year, my book was out in Japanese, and they discontinued the program. So I've never been to Japan.
Which and for you it'd be interesting because you've got manga is such a big aspect to a lot of the research you've been doing.
Yeah.
As far as understanding comics, it would be neat to kind of for you to like get into the heads of some of the artists there. Because I guess part of your research is I'm making a big presumption here. Is it the fact that you've been able to be in contact with a lot of artists, or is it over communicate over the internet and stuff?
Well, about manga specifically?
Just your research, because you communicate with a lot of artists, especially with making comics.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm really interested. You know, Duchamp said that as he got older, he was less interested in art and more interested in artists. And I'm starting to head a little bit in that direction, is that I love to know what makes artists tick and the comics culture that's out there. And one of the cool things that's happening now is that a lot of the manga kids are starting to swallow a lot of that stuff and metabolize it. It's breaking it down into their bloodstream. And they're getting to the point where it's integrated into their artistic personality. People like Brian Lee O'Malley to Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, so you're talking about manga readers here.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is like manga. There's more manga readers in North America than there are of superhero comics, I understand.
I think we might have passed that point, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely if you go into your average bookstore, that's definitely true.
Well, they did a manga convention at SFU in the fall last year, and it was huge. Huge. We do a comic convention in Vancouver, and it's at Heritage Hall. So there's your kind of your balance of the difference there. I think Sophia Books actually had a table there, and they literally had lineups all day, constantly people forking over money because they have a substantial manga selection. Yeah. So let's jump right into making comics, because this is the point of your tour. You've been, probably exhausting yourself, chatting about it, talking about it, teaching about it. But what was the, for this book, is it... Do you see it as a third part of your creative trilogy?
Well, it is now. You know, I didn't know it was going to be a trilogy, and then boom, it was. Although I guess when I did the second book, it was like, well, nothing comes in twos. You know, right? It doesn't feel right.
That's the law from Nancy, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, three rocks.
Right. Yeah, Art Spiegelman talked about that in Nancy. Ernie, this is such a sidetrack, but I got to say this.
Go ahead.
Okay, all right.
This is what people love.
In Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy, which we love because we would read it year after year after year, and it was never funny. But Art Spiegelman talked about the fact that he reduced everything to such a formula that when Nancy would be walking along, there'd be some rocks on the ground, and it would always be three rocks, because if it was two rocks, that wouldn't be some rocks, that would be a pair of rocks. Whereas if it was four rocks,
it would be a pile.
It would be some rocks, but it would be one rock more than was necessary to convey the idea of some rocks. So it was always three rocks. And now I've completely forgotten the question.
Making comics, what was your impetus to do it?
I think it's impetus. No, I've forgotten. I did it because I've been teaching these courses. Actually, in 2002, the Minneapolis College of Art and Design got me out to do this course. It was really funny because they asked me, could you teach like a 5-day seminar in making comics? I've never done anything like this. And they asked me this question. A guy named Peter Gross, who's up there, is also a cartoonist. And I thought, well, let me think about this. You know, it's a job. let me sit down and think about this. And I started to put together a syllabus. And I think, I have to do a syllabus. 10 minutes into the syllabus, suddenly it was like somebody had just taken their finger out of the dike, and all these ideas just came thundering out of me. I realized, oh my God, all these years when I've been trying to figure out how comics work, I was also sort of secretly in the back of my head, I was working on how to make comics, and making the syllabus was just, it just unleashed all of these ideas. And then I taught this class for a good 4 years before it was time to begin work on the book. But I knew, I really knew how to do it, because this wasn't just theory. I had actual living, breathing human beings trying out this stuff, you know? And it was working for them. And I thought, this is great. I've got to put this stuff on paper.
What, was it hard to go from theory to practice?
Not this time. It was hard. Like, the second book was a hard book to write for various reasons. This book was actually a lot easier. I felt confident in the usefulness of the stuff. And I had tools that I was comfortable with, too. Because I had finally made the transition all the way from paper to digital. And I finally had digital tools that I was actually comfortable with, including this gargantuan monitor where you can draw directly on the screen. The Cintiq monitor, this thing that tips down and tips up, it rotates 360 degrees. It's like working on paper. And finally, I had the perfect tool. And what's ironic is that this was something that I had described almost in exact detail in 1978 on a bus to Syracuse with my friend Kurt Busick. I had said, someday there's going to be this thing and I'm going to be able to draw directly on this screen, and there'll be all these digital things attached to it, and I'll be able to take lines away and put them in, and then I'll just be drawing right on the screen, and someday I will have this, and I will just wait until they invent it.
And Kurt was probably nodding politely.
Yeah. Well, that's what he did with everything that I told him. Whatever. Go back to his reading.
Now, you do get into a little bit of theory with making comics, too. The one part, I was at SPX, and I saw you do
Oh, God, yeah. You saw me in full-out lunatic mode.
What? What are you talking about?
The four schools of comics, I guess it was. And while you were doing it, you're also a little ashamed with yourself for doing it at the same point.
Yeah, but
I
think it's my toxic theory.
But I think it's really interesting because I agree with some of it, but I think like it's kind of limiting in the same part. Mm-hmm. And you're probably thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's quite interesting. And I'd like to maybe, you know, let people hear about that, because I think that's one of the more interesting theories in there. Like the rest of it, like for me, not being a cartoonist, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily get into as much of the book because, you know, I love reading him. But I love the stuff behind the stuff. Like, you know, I do this radio show where I talk to artists and find out some of their own, you know, and this is kind of neat to see, like, the different gatherings. So I think, what do we got? Let's go right into it.
So you describe it?
Yeah.
Okay, well, first of all, I got to say this. I got to prep you for this and say, okay, if anyone's listening to this and you hear the show and, like, a friend of yours who knows comics doesn't, and you want to summarize the show, please don't lead off by saying, well, McLeod says there are four kinds of artists. Because, you see, that's where I'm going to get in trouble with this, is saying there are four kinds of artists. Of course, the truth is...
I would say it's more like four type of artistic genre groupings?
Yeah, well, that's just it. It's not so much that individuals can be like put in these boxes. There are a lot more than four kinds of artists. There are as many kinds of artists as there are artists, right? There are millions of different reasons why people make art. But when people get together at conventions, they get together at the bar, or, you know, they get together on message boards, whatever it is, they gather around these campfires. And the campfires are a lot simpler. There are a few very simple ideals, like, you know, like knowledge or beauty or honesty or life, storytelling. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that give rise to what I see is about approximately four different tribes. One of them is the classicists, who are really interested in creating something beautiful and well-crafted and masterful. One of them are the animists, who are interested in conveying the story in a transparent way. Another is the formalists, who are interested in taking apart the medium and put it back together. Another is the iconoclasts, who are interested in that raw, brutally honest message. And there are all sorts of different dynamics between them. You know, they represent, on the one side, two of those schools are about tradition, and two of them are about revolution. A different two, you know, it's thinking north-south. If you arrange them in a little square, as I do, it's sort of like north-south is sort of the tradition-revolution axis, and then east-west is kind of this art-life split. The two of those schools are very interested in the value of art, and two are very interested in the value of life. And then you have these two dichotomies in the diagonals of form versus content and beauty versus truth. I had this idea like 12 years ago, and I didn't publish it because I thought, this will do more harm than good, right? You know, before you know it, people will be saying, oh, you wouldn't understand. You're just an animist. Or you're like, McLeod says that you can't do that kind of comic because of his theory of the types of artists. I thought, oh, this is terrible. But it made a fun party game. The reason
No actual like, fist fights.
This
or
is like Pictionary.
Oh, they'll come too. Yeah, oh. It's like Pictionary, yeah. Oh. But I thought, no, finally I realized, no, this is worth publishing because there are a few reasons. One of them is the fact that sometimes we're born into a particular circle. And we approach our gurus and they say, here's the secret of comics, right? Here's what comics is all about. They're going to give you an answer. Well, that's one of four different answers you could get. And that answer may not be right for you. You know, it could be that deep in your heart, even though you're hanging out with the classicists, even though they're telling you that it's all about hard work and skill and practicing and life drawing and looking at Hal Foster and Alex Ross or whoever, the truth is that maybe deep in your heart, you just want to be R. Crumb.
Oh, gasp.
But you know what I mean? It's just like you may have this rebel inside of you, and it's thinking, well, I guess I got to buckle down. I got to do what they're telling me because this guy, he's amazing, and you know he knows the answer. I have to do what this guy says. But it's like that guy may not be your tribe.
Well, wouldn't people just discover their tribe naturally from, you know, the comics they read and what inspires them growing up?
Absolutely. In 10 or 15 years, I think they'll find the career that's right for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want them to waste as much time as that.
Oh.
And also, you know, it's always good to have that broad view, you know, and just say, oh, wow, you know what? There are these different nations of comics. And it helps understand, too, like when James Kochalka said, craft is the enemy. Basically, that was a shot across the bow of the beauty truth dichotomy, right? And then when someone like Frank Cho like comes back and says, well, alternative comics artists can't draw, right? That's just a shot right back the same way.
And it's pretty like, girls.
Right, yeah, pretty girls, yeah. But here you have one dichotomy, and it's like I'm basically saying, dude, that's only half the picture, right?
Well, you do also talk about how one artist might embody two of these ideas.
Yeah.
Like personally, I had the most sympathy for the animus and the iconoclast, which
and incidentally, I would have pegged you if you'd asked. I would have said, as you were formulating that sentence, I was thinking to myself, if he asks, what am I going to say? And that's exactly what I would have said.
Yeah.
Which means, okay, the two the thing they have in common in the life art dichotomy, it's about life. And I'd be willing to bet that do you grok that? Does that feel about right? That you're very much about life. That at a certain point, art is all well and good. But
grok?
That life trumps. Oh, I'm sorry. It's an old Heinlein.
I haven't heard that in years.
I forgot that is an uncommon usage. Oh. It's an old Heinlein thing to grok. It's from Stranger in a Strange Land.
Well, I guess I would say that I think the most important, one of the most important things to me is being able to tell a story about real people.
Right. And if you can tell that story to the point where the comic falls away, people forget they're even reading a comic.
Yeah.
Have you done your job?
I think so.
And that I think is one of the values of The Animist.
Mm-hmm.
And The Animist, actually, even though I'm on the opposite end of the form and content acts, because they're on the content corner, I'm sort of the opposite corner, even though I have to say that The Animists are actually responsible for creating more readers than the other three schools combined.
Damn straight.
Yeah, because they create the stories that we cherish from generation to generation. So you got guys like Charles Schulz, you got Jeff Smith. You know, these are the people, they wake up in the morning. Well, not Charles, because, you know, that would be fortunately lost him. But they wake up in the morning and they ask their characters what they want to do. And they realize, you know, if this does not serve my instincts of where the story should go, it doesn't matter how much theory I can I can pull out of my hat. You know, it just doesn't feel right.
But didn't you use that when you were writing Zot?
Oh, yeah. No, you can't. It's impossible not to employ all four of those schools when you're working. The question is, what's the fire that gets you going? What's your passion? And when push comes to shove, what's the tiebreaker? When you look and you think, this will be more beautiful, this will be more honest, where do you make that decision? You know, David Mack could do a comics page where a guy is choking on his own vomit, lying in a gutter. And he will make it beautiful, because beauty trumps truth at the end of the day for that particular artist.
Wow, so have they printed the t-shirts yet?
They would sell in the millions. I tell you, David Mack has an army. He's like Jonan Vasquez, David Mack. There are a few key artists that have their own armies.
I mean,
I thought you meant the David Mack choking in his own vomit shirt.
No. So people at conventions could, you know, they could find each other.
Yeah, and then they could, like, do the thing where they point, like the guys from Michigan with the hand. Do you know about that? We're too far west.
I don't have cable. You know,
and north.
If you're in Toronto, you would know. But guys from Michigan, when you ask them where do they live, they just hold up their hand and then they point to the hand because the state looks like a hand.
Really?
Sorry, I found this out recently. I shouldn't assume everybody knows it, because I didn't even know it until a year ago.
I stay away from Michigan. It's in two parts. Make up your mind.
That's true. It's confusing.
It is. In fact,
they have to use the other hand for the other part.
What's the point of having a state that's not contiguous?
It would be like a hand and a foot.
Yeah, something like that.
There we go.
Yeah. Anyway, it's better than Florida, because that would be... You'd have to unzip for that.
Should be part of Canada.
Yeah. It should.
We don't want
it. Should. That would make a lot more sense.
The thing I really liked about putting that in there is the fact that... And with yourself, you're like frustrated that you come up with it. But I think it's also important that for comics to kind of be critical of itself. Mm. And, you know, sometimes groupings are not essential, but sometimes it's good for people to kind of see which direction things are going in, how things are coming. And, like, here's something you're pointing out now in 2000, I guess, 6 was when this was published.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're looking at, using this on something that's 100 years old.
Right. And hopefully we'll still have relevance in 20 and 30 years.
And everything kind of groups off and things. It must be interesting now doing this book and just seeing the comics, I feel like, really have changed since understanding comics, like the amount of experimentation that's come out since then.
Yeah. Yeah, some of it actually, in a way, there was some excessive experimentation that started to get on the art comics loyalists, started to get to them. I mean, you know, there was a lot of griping in certain circles that people were doing too many... cardboard fold-out mini-comics that could be read in 17 different directions and were based on a non-Euclidean geometric truncated icosadodecahedron, you know, starring, you know, the adventures of a triangle or whatever.
Sounds Lovecraftian.
It does.
A multi-tentacled beast will come out when you fold it the wrong way.
Yeah, we got to talk later about the Jack Chick parody that used Cthulhu. But But in a way, I think I took some of the blame for that, probably legitimately, because when I did Understanding Comics in 93, basically I was saying, comics can go everywhere. Comics could be anything.
Non-sequitur
transitions. You could do comics that were just a giant roll of polyethylene stretched on an elephant and, you know, all that sort of thing. And then there were people who actually tried that. And after a while, of course, the cry was like, okay, this is fine. We've been experimenting for a while, but where's the story? And that was sort of the knock on, like, the SPX scene about circa 1998, was like, where's the story, dude? And of course, the funny thing was, and this was something that Will Eisner brought up when I saw him visit SPX for the first time in the late 90s, he was saying, where's the story? And I said, Will, you know what? For every one of those guys who's doing the little silkscreen denim Day Globe mini comic about Godzilla, those guys, every one of them, they're working on a 400 or 500-page graphic novel in the back. And this was when, honestly, one of those little mini comics belonged to Craig Thompson. So I get points for profit on that one. But, you know, these guys are all working on their big stories as they experiment. But the experimentation helps to inform their understanding of the medium, helps them triangulate the shape of their medium. And when it comes time to do that gigantic graphic novel, they do a really good job.
I was just wondering, when I was reading Making Comics, it was all about storytelling and clarity. Mm. And I'm wondering, you know, what some people might consider that, you know, putting restrictions on artistic creativity.
Ah, or experimentation.
Experimentation, yeah.
Yes. But remember the tribe of the author. Remember that I'm actually a formalist. I'm like Mr. Experimentation. In fact, almost everything I did after understanding comics was experimental. Some of it virtually unreadable because I was only interested in experimentation. And yet, I was talking almost exclusively in Making Comics about the art of creating work where the content comes first, where all of the form falls away. So why? Well, there are two reasons. Number one is the fact that that storytelling impulse, that desire to create a story that's simply pure, clear storytelling, that's our raison d'etre. That's why comics exists, because of that impulse to tell stories. It's like sex has a lot of different purposes, a lot of different things that can come out of sex, but there's one particular
ultimately
evolution.
It's procreation.
Yeah, right. Procreation kicked it off, right? Procreation got it started, and then all this other stuff grew out of procreation, even if it has, you know, there's plenty of sexual activity has nothing to do with procreation, right? Well, likewise, there's a lot of activity in comics that has nothing to do with just telling a story. But that's where it begins, so you have to understand that. The other reason is because I'm trying to figure this out too, because I want to do a graphic novel, and the ultimate accomplishment for a formalist like me, for one of the experimental wing, is to impersonate an animist.
Right? Is to put on a mask.
Right, exactly. Is to take everything we've learned about comics, all of you, we've taken apart, we have all the parts lying there, and then we bury them in the sand. So that when you read our comic, you'll go, wow, it just looks like he just like woke up one day and just put a pen in his mouth and fell onto the paper. When in fact, everything is calculated. You know, and so that's my goal too, is I'm trying to teach myself to be that other guy.
And isn't that kind of what Art Spiegelman tried to do with Mouse, where he tried to just do the perfect story?
Yes, exactly what he did with Mouse. He tried to impersonate Adams. I have proof of it too, because my editor, Kat Ironwood, at the time, back in Eclipse Comics days, she was visiting Art when he was working on Mouse, and he had this caption in the shape of a railway ticket, and the caption was saying that, you know, I bought a ticket to such and such a place, right? It's like his father telling the story. And Kat said, hey, I really like this ticket in the shape of a railway ticket. This caption in the shape of a railway ticket. That's really clever. And Art said, I'll take it out. And Kat said, no. I said, I like it. And he said, yes, but you stopped reading.
Ah,
right? Yeah. Now, this is a guy who had done up to that point, who had done comic after comic, where you stopped reading every 10 lines, right?
Yeah.
Because he wanted you to be...
Two-fisted painters.
Yeah, exactly, and right. Yeah, or any...
Ace-hole midget detective.
Right, or the one you could read in any direction, you know, all of these things. And yet, he was putting all that behind him and impersonating his opposite number. Now, of course, he gets to the end of Volume 1, and he can't hold it back anymore. And then suddenly it's all meta jokes and people wearing mouse masks and stuff like that. Because he couldn't keep it at bay too long.
One thing I find interesting with that is that a lot of people have issues with the Two Towers book he did. Because he goes full on into doing what he really wants to do with that, which I really enjoyed it, but a lot of people are finding criticism going, well, it's not Mouse again.
Well, I think any self-respecting formalist would have been disappointed if he just did Mouse again. But the Two Towers book, I think, was a necessary book for him. It was emotionally necessary. The man was there when the towers fell. And, in fact, I saw him only about a month later at, maybe it was at SPX, I don't remember, it was Chicago Humanities Festival, and he was... He's really shaken up by the whole thing. And so he was working out a lot of stuff.
You could really tell by in the reading of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It feels like, you know, okay, we're up close and personal with a man who's like really dealing with a lot of stuff. But he works it out like any form. He works it through his system, and now the next thing he's doing looks nothing like any of those.
I've the portrait of an artist as
a
young...
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, right.
Listener discretion, be advised. Yeah. It's really great stuff.
It's wonderful.
I look forward to seeing it in print.
It's a lit anthology, an academic lit anthology, Virginia Quarterly Review, and there's been about three parts to it. It's basically going through his whole kind of getting into comics and his early career inspiration and struggles and how Mouse has been kind of that monkey on his back.
And all the panels are like the same size. So he can reflow. He can like cut it just like Chester did with, you know, we were talking about Chester Brown, how he would just do the panels individually and then smack them down on the page. That's what art's doing now. You can do a kind of purge and reflow. If all of your panels are the same size, then you take out a panel and it just all reflows.
And he's being pretty self-critical from this one, from understanding, because I got an email from a listener who is taking a class with him and is saying he brought it into his class to show it to the students to kind of get input from them to see how the story's going. And he's, you know, I think he's trying to work on doing that next perfect story. On that note, it's 5:30. I'll remind people we're CITR 101.9 FM Inkstuds. We're talking to Scott McLeod. We're going to do another song break. Mr. Blue Sky, who was that again that did that?
Electric Light Orchestra.
What? Oh, my.
Used in Boogie Nights.
Hey.
Man, I grokked that.
We played Mark Allman for Chester Brown, so.
Cool.
We'll play anything.
We'll like play Mark anything.
What you do, everybody's wise as you.
I forgot about that boring last part.
Yellow.
But I love that.
We can have it like behind us while we're talking. How do you like that?
Jeff Lynn, great producer.
Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. This is the radio show where we talk about comics. This week we're joined by our special guest, Scott McCloud, who tonight is doing a Q&A and signing at Sophia Books.
At 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock, part of his worldwide journey.
Oh, and don't be discouraged if it looks dark. The signing's in the back.
Yeah,
oh, just,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
We went to a thing for Mark Bell did a little thing there for Naga Dodd, mm-hmm. With Jason McLean and some of his local talented guys, Mark DeLong, and yeah, it was dark in there.
Oh, but I'll be ready for that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, Mark Bell has an art opening tonight at the Graff Gallery.
Really, I hadn't heard.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
So
where's that?
Well, I was just
meaning
we won't be there.
Well, you should have checked.
I think it's a different crowd.
Okay, yeah, that's probably
wait,
true.
Wait, where are they? The not the iconoclast.
I think he's in a whole class of his own. God bless.
No, I'm pretty sure I can figure it out.
Now, also, just a quick couple of things before we get back in the conversation. Remind people, Sunday is the comic convention, Heritage Hall. You've been to one at one point, I think. Leonard brought you up. And this week's guest, or this month's, this time's, is Carrie Nord and a plethora of other local talented kids. And yeah, it should be fun. I'll be there for the first hour, and then I have to go run a comic store.
It's always a good idea.
My life is comics, as is yours.
Yeah.
The worldwide tour. Now, I'm going to go right into your history here, because like, you live and breathe comics. It's interesting. Sitting at SPX, I sat not very far from you at my friend's table, and I just saw kids, just a lineup of kids, just there to give you stuff. You weren't even selling your book. You were just there to say hi. I thought this was most interesting, just kind of absorbing the comics.
Which is really cool, usually, although actually when we're on the road, it's a bit of a problem. People keep giving us gifts. It's like, you know, that's, I love you, you're wonderful, we live in a car.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, you don't even have a
great
van?
No, it's a gray Toyota Sienna.
Oh.
So it's a minivan.
Right.
But it's like it's got everything we need for an entire year. And we have my pregnant niece and her luggage joining us for the trip to Alaska. So if anyone out there is thinking of bringing anything to Sophia's Books, we love you. We appreciate it. I might give you an address to send.
There we go.
How do you broach this tour idea with your family?
Oh, actually, it went in the other direction. The tour was entirely my wife's idea, Ivy.
Really?
Yeah, Ivy always wanted to see all 50 states. And we never really had the excuse. We never had the resources. I was always like, yeah, that'll be fine when we could take a year off. Well, suddenly the new book comes out, and it's like time to promote the book. It's like, ding, right? You know, we're in New York. Actually, we're there for Will Eisner's memorial. But we met with my publishers, and we were like, yeah, we're thinking of taking this 50-state tour. And that was it. The moment we mentioned it, their eyes lit up, and it was like, ooh, promotional tour. And we're like, well, kind of a, I guess, sort of a promotion. Ooh, and then you could do this, and you could do this. Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, okay. But in the end, that was a really good idea, because the lectures and the seminars pay for, you know, hotel and things like that. And then we get to just go places and do stuff, and it's worked really well. But it was Ivy was definitely the brain, the genius behind it.
So you haven't been home in
actually
almost a year?
We went back to California for 1 week at the end of March because Kazuo Kibuishi and Amy Kim Ganter, two really talented young cartoonists, were getting married, and they had me officiate at the wedding. And they just happen to live in Southern California, so we had to fly back to our old digs in order to
should visit. We start calling you Reverend Scott?
Yeah. Actually, the state of California gave me the power to marry those two people and only on that day.
Aww.
So I couldn't like run out into Hollywood and start randomly.
Well, I am a member of the Universal Church of Life, so if
oh, so you
talk
can
later.
Also perform marriages.
Yeah. I'm a minister of the Church of the Subgenius.
In high school, I was part of the Church of the Holy Mackerel, but that was a thing.
Oh. Now, it must be interesting for
your spiritual bunch.
For your daughters going on this and like being able to really experience so many different cultures and stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's
I don't know.
Wild.
And you're doing like homeschooling with them, I guess, for the year.
Car schooling, hotel schooling, yeah.
So when are you going to Nunavut?
Not yet.
Oh.
I forgot where that is. Wait.
Oh, well, remember the Northwest Territories?
Oh, right.
It's split
in. I'm sorry about that. Yes, we are, actually.
You're going?
We're doing the Alcan Highway. We're driving all the way to
Alaska. None of it's... Is it's east. It's like above
Northwest Territories.
It's the Northwest Litton, Territories, but it's east.
It's the eastern part of the north. What used to be the Northwest Territories.
You may go through the Yukon.
Yeah, we are going through the Yukon,
which is the west.
We're going up through BC and then the Yukon.
Are you doing
which
a signing?
Is lovely.
No, unfortunately, no. We were talking for a little while. We were thinking of doing a library in Prince George, but it didn't work out time-wise.
I know a big comic fan, I think, in is it Prince George or further north than that, I think, that has like the best taste in comics and gets everything shipped up from our local comic store.
Is there anyone in the Yukon who's listening who'd like Scott McCloud to come and do a presentation in their living room?
ScottMcCloud.com. I may be spending a night in your town. You never know. It's possible.
Any chance to talk. It's been like that, though. Like, you just did something in the last minute in Seattle, right?
Where yeah, like with like 3 days' notice. I just did an informal, like, sit and talk to about 150 students at the Seattle Art Institute. So that can happen. We did last minute at Savannah College of Art and Design with 11 days' notice. We had, like, over 600 people at a downtown theater. And you know, so it's, these things can come together very fast sometimes.
It must be pretty awe-inspiring just meeting so many fans, so many comic people. Do you kind of see like this whole like different world? Because SPX is one thing where it's like in conventions where it's like, you know, this community, and tends to be the convention or the same people at conventions.
Yeah.
So this is different where you get to see this whole world
in their natural habitat. Yeah, I get to go to Matt Fazell's house, and like there are 12, you know, in Detroit, Michigan. We're actually Hamtramck, Michigan, which is surrounded by Detroit, where Matt's wife is actually the mayor. And this is like,
what?
Yes,
when
yes,
does that happen?
Karen Majewski is now the mayor of Hamtramck. It's like it's completely surrounded by Detroit, but it's its own little city. Wow. And people come over like to Matt's house on Wednesday night, and like about 12 cartoonists will just sit and draw. It's its own little thing, its own little nation. But it's really cool trying to keep track of the different nations of comics, because one of the most exciting things that's happened in comics is that the medium of comics has finally grown so big that the curve of the planet is visible, and there are nations of comics that are just over the horizon that cannot even see each other now. That's like it's because it used to be that we go to San Diego, we could get everybody in one room, and you knew they were there. Maybe you weren't necessarily reading what was going on at Archie, but you knew Archie. You
know, you knew Archie it was there. Goodwin?
You knew Archie Comics.
Oh,
you know, you knew Archie Comics and Marvel and DC, and then the Underground, and you could sort of put them all in your head at once. But now, the Penny Arcade fans don't necessarily know about the existence of the David Mack fans, don't necessarily know about the existence of the Baby Club, the Babysitters Club graphic novel fans, who don't necessarily know about Jonah and Vasquez. It's too big.
Well, I think it's because the readers now, they don't depend so much on the comic shops.
Mm-hmm. They're
going to the bookstores.
Right, so they're not hanging out with each other. I think that's exactly right. The bookstores and the web. Mm-hmm. And all of that together, and the manga kids, you know, they're in their own little world. They're not necessarily aware of what's even happening down at the end of the aisle with the graphic novels.
But at the same time, I've noticed amongst cartoonists, like we were having dinner once, and we were hanging out with this woman from Taiwan who was drawing Japanese style comics, and there were all these Canadian local cartoonists and this woman from Taiwan who were all talking about Hergé and Taniguchi and, you know, peep cartoonists from Europe and Japan and Malaysia, and we all of us there knew who we were talking about.
Well, that's an interesting fact, is that when you get serious about your comics, when you get serious about the work, that's the point at which you rise to that artistic altitude where you can look down on the world and you realize, okay, maybe I'm never going to draw like Hergé. Maybe I'm never going to draw like Tezuka. Maybe I'm never going to draw like Dan DiCarlo. But I need to understand where these people were coming from and why they had their own kingdoms of comics. Why is Karl Barks important? Why is John Stanley important? That's how you get to, you know, see the shape of the comics world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what was it that really got you going into comics? So, like, going from Zot, where you just, it was a fun, kind of experimental space jaunt. Is that a good
guess,
term?
Yeah.
Dimensional thing.
Going from that to understanding comics, like, what was your, you know, the change in wanting to kind of get into the dirt of it?
Well, you know, it seems kind of abrupt going from this, you know, sort of harmless postmodern superhero comic to these books about comics. But it was very natural for me, because the whole time I was doing the superhero comic, I was trying to figure out how comics worked, you know, and I was trying things out. I was trying out these different techniques, you know, like masking effects or certain types of transitions, just to see if they could work. And then, you know, jumping onto understanding comics, it was suddenly, okay, let's turn the stage around. Here's the back of the stage. And let's just talk about what was going on in the back of the stage the whole time, you know, while I was getting ready and, you know, working the lights and changing costumes in the back. So I saw it as flip sides of the same coin. But on the page, they look radically different. So it looked like I could completely reinvent myself, I guess.
Do you ever worry about, I don't know, spending too much cerebral energy analyzing things? Like, so much of what is drawn in comics, what I draw in comics, is simply intuitive.
Right.
Do you ever fear that you might overanalyze it?
Well, yeah. Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's no question that you can go too far in that direction, and I pretty much have. But but that's why my next project is a graphic novel. Oh. And this one is a story that I've had in mind for over 20 years. It's going to run to 300 or 400 pages. And in order to do it right, I want to make sure that the reading experience is pure and clear. And I'm going to do exactly that thing I was talking about, the formalist impersonating an animist. I'm going to bury all the parts in the sand. If I can do my job right, you won't have any idea that this was the work of a very analytical process. It's going to hopefully look like a very natural and organic process.
Can you talk about what the book's about?
Nope. not because I'm, like, protecting it, but because sometimes I talk too much about things ahead of time and it drains the energy from them.
Right.
This one I want to come out of my hands, not out of my mouth.
We had Jeff Smith on, he's mentioning his next book that he's going to do. Wouldn't go into details, and poor Colin got scarred. What's it going to be about? I think it was like...
Fucking and death.
Yeah. God bless.
You lost your mind?
Kevin Eastman did that. Kevin Eastman's 24-hour comic was called Fuck the Dead, but they didn't...
Listener discretion be advised. Yeah, yeah. We are in Canada,
really
thank God.
You find out a lot about people when they do their 24-hour comics.
Well, he changed the name when he actually published it, though, too. Oh. No Guts, No Glory. But that was the original title.
Right.
So there you go. So someone's already been there.
Now, 24-hour comics, that was something that you started or pushed?
Yeah. That was back in 1990. I challenged my friend Steve Bissett to do a whole comic in a day because I thought he could. Because I knew he could because I'd seen him do sketches at stores and things, and he was amazing, even though he's known as Steve Glacier Bissett. and he did it. I had to do mine first because I knew I couldn't get him to do it unless I did one first. So I did mine. He did his. And then he sent it to like Sim and Veach and Neil Gaiman and... And before you knew it, we had another, you know, 5 or 6 people had done them. Then another 50 or 60 people have done it. And now thousands
it's
and
huge.
Thousands of
like,
people.
Like, I saw the most recent couple collections, and they're like an inch thick or something. Probably
yeah.
More than
well,
that.
Well, there's even now a day. I mean, the 24-hour comics day, which takes place, I think, now in October. It was originally in April, but now it's in October.
People gather in comic shops?
Yep, comic shops and other
their 24-hour comics?
Colleges, yes. Yeah.
There's also people that do the hourly comic day.
That's right, yeah.
I think that was in February, where every hour... would be like a 2-panel thing.
Oh.
And that's actually
heard about that one.
The greatness of the internet, where it's worked out well, is that kind of information sharing, where it's like, I'm kind of like mixed on internet comics thing. We only got 10 minutes left, but that's a half one of your books.
Isn't it cool, though, that we got this far without even talking about that? I think that's kind of amazing.
One thing I do appreciate about making comics, it seems a return to, you know, the content of comics. As opposed to the delivery.
But here's the funny thing is that it's not so much that I was... I mean, yes, that's true. But it might also be seen as a return to paper, but it's not really that at all.
No, there's how-to with the computer as well.
Yeah, I do talk about computer digital technology. But also what's interesting is that as radically different as digital comics can be, the fundamental storytelling principles that govern printed comics and digital comics are more or less the same. So, you know, I can do an entire book where I'm talking about storytelling principles, and I almost never have to specify which kind I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the neat part.
one thing I noticed, I don't know how you feel about where it's at with the internet comics, web comics. I kind of like, I see some stuff where we see communities of people doing, pushing each other with the hourly comic thing. Yeah. But there's a big part of me that seems like it's kind of wasted that people kind of see, oh, well, it's the internet, I'm just going to do a two-panel thing. Do you kind of see, like, the potential there not being really fully realized?
Yeah, well, I've been looking at comics all my life, and that's what I always see. I mean, that's what I saw in 1993 when I did Understanding Comics. That's what I saw when I did my first comic. It's actually what I saw when I was about 11 years old, and I had a very negative view of comics when I was a little kid. Right? I thought comics were just for dumbbells. And then, you know, my friend Kurt Busa kept getting me to try, you know, you should read these things. And I was over at a friend of mine's, a guy named Chris Bing, who's actually a children's book illustrator now, and he had a copy of a Steranko Captain America.
The beautiful design work.
And I looked at that and I just thought, basically, even at like 11, 12 years old, my thought was, wow, comics have potential. You know, that was my attitude. Wasn't that, wow, comics are great. It was more like, oh, I get it. There's all this stuff that has been done, but then there's all this other stuff that could be done. That's what I always see. That's what I see when I look at the internet, when I look at manga, graphic novels, superhero comics, is there's this tiny little settlement on this huge continent of possibilities.
How would you feel about mentioning some books that you feel that, you know, because not everyone that's listening to this show, I mean, we're a broadcast show, there's a lot of people that don't necessarily read comics that are listening, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some books you think that people should really check out that are pinnacle pieces of comics lore? You know, I don't want to say canons of comics, because I saw the Gary Groth panel with Ivan Brunetti and stuff, and they hated the term canon. But yeah. What are some pinnacle works that people should check out?
I think the most challenging, you know, so one of the greatest achievements of the graphic novel movement is probably Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan. But it's a hard read. I mean, you have to be somebody who's really willing to do the work of, you know, like reading a full-out novel of considerable length and complexity. It's that kind of experience, but it's worth it. It's marvelous stuff.
I really hated that. Until I realized how strongly I identified with the main character. then I saw it differently.
I think we all do on some level.
Yeah.
And then for sheer fun, funniest comic on the planet right now is something called Scott Pilgrim, which I mentioned earlier, I think.
And it's Canadian?
It's Canadian, actually, yeah. He's living in Halifax, and a lot of it takes place in Toronto.
I asked Chester Brown what are some comics he's enjoying right now, and he mentioned Scott Pilgrim. I was a little surprised. I asked what he thought of Fun Home, and he went,
I love Fun Home. Fun Home by Alison Bechdel is another one.
It was more into the Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah, well, Scott Pilgrim's more, you know, goes down easier, but Fun Home is actually really cool by Alison Bechdel.
It was Book of the Year from some big magazine.
All of Seattle read Persepolis. I'm wrong. Persepolis is another interesting one
with the movie coming out this year.
Yeah, which just won the jury prize. Shared the jury prize with another one
at Con.
At Con.
Yeah,
Persepolis.
Con.
A local cartoonist, Jason Turner, is it?
Yeah.
True Loves.
I'm hoping, Jason, if you're out there, should come by the
coming
signing.
Tonight.
Excellent.
That was nominated for the Vancouver Reads Project.
Oh, fantastic.
It didn't make the top cut, but it was nominated.
If only it had been printed in color, it would have made it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Jason's color work is gorgeous.
I love his color work. I was a little sad that they could only afford to print it in black and white. Though I understand why that can be necessary. That's a really great color book. You know, I mean, if it wasn't color, it's good color work. I got to know it on the web. On the web, I can't recommend webcomics right now because I get in trouble every time I do.
Why is that?
Well, because
you didn't recommend my book.
Yeah, basically, when you have approximately 30,000 working cartoonists on the web, and you could recommend 100, and that is 29,900 cartoonists who are pissed off at you. But also, it's still in flux, and things. There's a lot that I read, but I have trouble like picking just one.
What would be the best way for someone to go and read web comics? Is there any? Is there
the best way is like all you need to do is find one you like, and then just check the links page, and then pretty soon you'll find out what do they like, and then what are the people that they like, and you can rise right to the cream of the crop very fast. It's pretty amazing.
And they're not all jokes about computers.
No, they're not all jokes about computers. And they're not all like three-panel gag strips. Although some of the three-panel, four-panel gag strips are actually really good. It's just that, some of them are extremely ambitious and complex and formally interesting and interesting stories.
I think we're near the end of our time here.
What? Already?
It's about 5-2. So I'm going to remind people, this was CITR 101.9 Ink Studs. Check us out online, inkstuds.com. Scott McCloud is tonight at Sophia's Books. signing and talking.
At 7.
At 7 o'clock. 7 till 9, I think, is the time. Or 7 to 10. 7 and
not
on.
Not sure. 7 on.
Well, we'll see what it's like.
Yeah. And I think Colin and I will be there.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely. So if Scott's busy signing stuff, you can say hi to me, Colin. You can also say hi to Scott's family.
Yeah. The whole gang will probably be there. Yeah. Ivy, Sky, and Winter.
I haven't seen Ivy for... Well, I don't think I've seen Sky since she was like...
Knee-high to a grasshopper?
Well, you know, this football-sized or something.
Sky is taller than her mom now.
Wow.
And she has red hair on the bottom, and Ivy has purple hair. Winter has a little streak of green.
They're little punk rockers.
Kind of. They're pretty cool. Really cool kids.
So are they sick of comics by now?
No, because I never pushed comics on them, which is interesting. When they discovered manga, I was like, I see. Because I had nothing to do with it.
Inside, you're like, yes!
Yeah, but they just totally found it on their own. Like, first through the anime, Rumiko Takahashi and stuff like that. My little one's really into Miyazaki.
They're quite bright. Like, I really enjoy reading the MacLeod tour.
I'm the worst promo guy in the world. I always forget to mention this. Go to scottmacleod.com. Click on the little cartoon of us driving, and then you'll see a link on the upper left-hand corner of the tour page. You'll see a link to our blog, and there all four of us and guest stars, including my niece who's coming with us to Alaska, will blog about our experiences on the road, pictures and video. And my youngest daughter, Winter, interviews comics professionals.
Wintercast, right?
The Winter Views, very Winter close, Views. Yeah. And they're produced entirely by my the older daughter, Sky, who does all the video editing herself. So it's an all-kid production. It's really cool.
That's pretty awesome.
Wow.
So check it out, scottmacleod.com. MacLeod spelt how it sounds, MCCLOUD.
Wow.
Colin. next week, we'll be joined by mini comic pioneer, continuer, Mr. John King Porcellino. Cat.
Oh, yeah, he's seminal influence on a whole generation.
His new book, King Cat Classics, from John and Corley. Week after, we're going to have Baron's Story. I'm very excited about that.
Wow. Teacher, a very influential teacher of many prominent artists.
Extremely influential. Dave McKeon, George Pryor. Colin, you should know Baron's Story.
Bill Sienkiewicz, I think.
Bill Sienkiewicz, Ken Williams.
I took Baron's Story. He did a guest stint at Syracuse.
Oh, wow. There
he's taught everybody.
Everybody, yeah. And in fact, we had Ron Rigi on last week, who was mentioning how he learned from you.
Oh, weird. Oh, cool. Oh, I wish I could ask him if he painted a wall in Seattle. I saw a wall that looked like a Ron Rigi drawing.
He did.
Cool.
He was in Seattle last week. Was it a chalk thing, or was it a...
Oh, no, actually, I think it was painted.
Oh, okay. He was in Seattle last week because he was on tour.
Was it a few blocks up from the Space Needle, I wonder?
I wonder. I don't know.
He says he used to do your photocopying.
He was at a Kinko's, you mean?
Yep.
Yeah.
Where? In Amherst?
When you were doing Zot.
You don't know? You didn't know that?
Maybe he told me and I forgot.
Probably.
I bet he told me.
You probably...
Like in Tarrytown, New York or something? This is so
some
weird.
Small town, you know, Massachusetts maybe.
It'd be like Amherst or...
Cambridge.
Or Arlington. Arlington
maybe.
Or Cambridge.
I think
Cambridge.
Kinko's, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, Cambridge isn't so small. But yeah, Kinko's, sure. Yeah. Wow, that's freaky.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, see you all tonight. Oh, the last song playing, Old Buttermilk Sky. Who is that?
By Hoagie Carmichael.
Hoagie Carmichael. There we go. Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you,
Grok.
Old Buttermilk Sky, I'm keeping my eye peeled on you. What's a good word tonight? Are you gonna be mellow tonight? Oh, Buttermilk Sky, can't you see my little donkey and me? We're as happy as a Christmas tree, heading for the one I love. I'm gonna pop her the question, that question. Do you, darling, do you do? It'll be easy, so easy, if I can only bank on you, oh, Buttermilk Sky. I'm telling you why, now you know. Keep it in mind tonight, keep brushing those clouds from sight. Oh, Buttermilk Sky, don't you feel me when I'm needing you most? Hang a moon above her hitching post, hitch me to the one I love.